thought I'd take the opportunity this evening of saying a little bit about a few things and not prepare too much, because you know, there's the story of Ajahn Sumedho, who was asked to give a talk by Lumpo Cha, and he was a junior monk, and he did it a few times, and then one day he decided to really prepare for his talk, and he gave a prepared, quite lucid, clear Dhamma talk in Thai. And soon after that, as Ajahn Chah was saying that, he said, "Don't ever do that again." So there's this feeling that Dhamma talk should be unprepared. Comes from that, and particularly on this day. And yet there's something in the structure of what we chanted this evening that is worth running through, at least, because so the story goes, it was one of the chants that Lumpo Cha really appreciated, and Vipassana Bhumi means sort of stages of insight or levels of insight. And certainly that's what there's some interest in, and it begins as you probably heard as we began it, Panchakanda, the five khandhas, and we've been chanting about those, and this is the world that we live in, and it begins there. And good enough place to begin, the Panchakanda. So we've been through those. That's one way of talking about the world. And then the next thing is Dvadasayatana. Yes, the 12 and 12 aspects of the faculties of the thing of being alive, the form and the sight, and then through the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and the mind, the six sense bases, and the internal and the external of that, and that sense of that, and then what makes it present is added in the next lot, which is the elements, I think. Yes, the 12 ayatanas and the 18 elements, and these are interesting because it's that sense of what comes together and what makes contact possible, eyes and the form, and then the thing that comes with that sense of making them present and giving that sense of the internal and the external is consciousness, and those three coming together are contact. So that's the sort of rundown of the world in two different ways, the five khandhas and the ayatanas and the ramifications around those. And then it goes on to the 22 faculties, which are the sort of faculties of life, or what makes sort of life sort of possible. And in this, all of these, it's they seem just like dry lists often, and yet, no, there's reasons that they've been put together in this way, and to try to, what I find useful is try to turn them over and use them in ways that actually sort of start to make sense and give them some something to work with. And in the 22, I start again with the six sense bases, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body and mind. And then to actually allow life to come through, you've got the feminine, the masculine, then life itself. In that order, which is again, I feel helpful. I, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, and then the feminine principle, the masculine principle, and then the life principle. Again, I think the order is important. That it begins with the feminine, then the masculine, and then with the two, then you have the two mixed is life itself. And what does life experience? As life, you have the pleasure and pain, and then the complication of pleasure and pain, which is the sense of joyous and rejoicing in things, and then the sense of sorrow and lamentation, which are the complications of life. And then the feeling from that, or the experience from that, or the faculty from that, is the possibility of some sort of sense of upeka, of levelness around it. And that is like the sort of, for me, that's like the sort of beginning of the feeling of, well, there must be some sort of way of dealing with all of this, some sort of way of being with all of this. And that is the arising of faith, sadha. And from that, energy and effort and the attention to then sustain it. So you've got sati and samadhi and the wisdom to continue to do that, panya. And with that, then there's the, what does panya actually realize? If there's panya at all, it realizes that there is stress, there is dukkha. But first of all, it has to know that it doesn't know that. It knows that it doesn't know. It knows the limitation of what it knows, and then it knows. And then it knows that it knows. And those are the 22 faculties. You've got the six sense bases, you've got the three that come up to life itself, you've got the experience of pleasure, pain, and the complications to do with that, and then upeka, and then the five usual indriya, with sata, sada, sada, virya, sati, samadhi, panya. And then panya knows that it doesn't know first, knows, and then knows that it knows. And what does it know? It knows the Four Noble Truths. And then from that, there's the other explanation of the Four Noble Truths, which is the paticca-samuppada, the dependent origination. And the way that it's set out here in this one is in forward and then reverse. The forward is sort of when one doesn't know, then one complicates things and goes to death. And then when there is the knowing, then there's dispassion, and with the dispassion there's the cessation, and with the cessation the whole thing falls apart, and there's nothing that is born and dies. So that's a sort of very sketchy outline of that profound chant, the Vipassana Bhumi, which yields more if it's learnt and taken to heart, and dwelt there, has a chance to actually dwell there. To end with the, you know, to start with just rupa and to end with the cessation over quite a short chant. It's only 10, 12 minutes. Worth it. Worth learning, worth contemplating. And what do all those funny Pali words mean to you? And as I said, this chant was one of Lumpur's favourite. It was, Ajahn Chandasiri mentioned, it was one that was chanted over the last sort of 10 years of Lumpur's life, as the communities gathered outside his kuti at Wat Pa Pong. And so I thought I'd read a little from a sort of biography. As some of you know, there's a beautiful biography in written in Thai by a friend of mine called Ajahn Jayasaro, called Upalamani, the sage of the of the lotus, begins with a rather beautiful. I don't read the Thai well enough to know for sure, but the poem at the beginning of that is a very classically beautiful Thai poem, which is a sort of paean of praise to Lumpur Cha, and the person who wrote that was quite an accomplished Thai writer from Ubon, who was actually paralyzed for about the same length of time as Lumpur Cha, and died a little bit after him, and was a friend of Ajahn Jayasaro's. One of the things that Ajahn Jayasaro wanted to do at one point was to translate that Thai book that he actually wrote with help from his disciples and friends into English, and it was a project that he began soon after Lumpur Cha's the cremation ceremony, because he worked very hard for the year from the actual death of Lumpur Cha till the cremation, to actually complete and get on the, you know, get produced Upalamani, the Thai book, which weighs almost exactly 2 kilos. He said he made it so heavy so that people wouldn't be able to read it in bed. the story is the Queen Mother of Thailand, when she first picked it up, couldn't put it down and read through the night. I think she was sitting up. the poem that I put on the servery this morning is Ajahn Jayasaro's sort of attempt in English as a sort of opening poem for that biography, which in fact will probably it's not certainly not going to be written by Ajahn Jayasaro. He gave up the whole project of trying to write it in English, and I think there is something being written, or probably nearly finished now, by an ex-bhikkhu called Paul Breiter Warapanyo, who at one time was tipped as the next abbot of Wat Nana Chat after Lumpur Samedo left. He was one of those monks that was incredibly competent, as a bhikkhu, in terms of his ability and his language skills were really, really good. And he could chant the Paṭimokkha standing on his head. I think it's something that Ajahn Sumedho could also do, but that's literally. Anyway, he disrobed, eventually he's done quite a few of the translations, and so he'll be doing the translation rewriting in some way, a biography of Ajahn Chah. But Ajahn Jayasaro did begin a biography, and there are a few sort of drafts around, and so I printed off one, I thought I'd read a little bit of that this evening. I do need light, so. This is just something about, I think I mentioned a couple of days ago, Lumpur Ginari, the funeral of which I attended. And a simple monk, a simple bhikkhu. This is Ajahn Jayasaro writing. Lumpur Ginari was probably the nearest that anybody came to being a teacher to Lumpur, in the conventional sense of that term. He was not a bhikkhu with an immediate charisma, and his reclusiveness meant that he was little known in the Tudong fraternity. But Lumpur said that the longer that he lived with Lumpur Ginari, the more his respect for him grew. Qualities that Lumpur recognized and particularly admired in Lumpur Ginari were his simplicity, his ability to maintain mindfulness in all postures, and his patient attention to detail. Lumpur Ginari had led an eventful monastic life. After receiving teachings from Lumpur Man and Lumpur Sao, he had spent many years wandering on Tudong, including over 10 years in Burma. He was one of only a handful of bhikkhus of his generation to have visited the Buddhist holy places in northeast India. He probably just walked there without a passport, don't worry. Yet, by the time Lumpur knew him, Lumpur Ginari did not have the air of a hard and seasoned traveller. Lumpur Ginari wore about him, however, like a well-used robe, a modest self-sufficiency and an ease that spoke of someone with nothing more to prove to himself. He seemed content with what each moment brought to him. Lumpur soon found that the fact that he rarely spoke was not the outcome of a brusque or taciturn personality, which is common among forest monks, but rather of a sweet, gentle nature that found a few things worth saying. He was an industrious man who would spend his days tinkering and pottering and sewing and cleaning. All of his requisites he made himself, and he used them until they fell apart. As he got older, his appearance was ever more shabby and decrepit, but Lumpur discovered looks can be deceptive. His mind was bright and clean. After a short initial visit, Lumpur continued his wanderings and then came back to Nong Gi to spend the rains retreat. He relates the kind of teaching that inspired him to return. This is Lumpur Cha now talking. At that time, I'd hear the teachers giving Dharma talks about letting go, and I couldn't still make much of anything of it. Lumpur Ginari asked me to sew a set of robes. I went at it flat out. I wanted to get it over and done with quickly. I thought, once the task is done, I'll be free for business, free of all the business, and be able to get down to some real meditation. One day Lumpur walked over. I was sewing in the sun, totally unaware of the heat. I just wanted to get finished so that I could devote myself to meditation. He asked me, "What's the hurry?" "I'm hurrying to get it finished." "When you're finished, what are you going to do?" "I'm going to meditate." "And after you've done that, what are you going to do?" "I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that." "And then when you finish with that, what are you going to do?" "Well, I'm going to go on and do this and do it some more." "And then what?" "There'll be no end to this." Lumpo Ginri said, "Don't you realize that just this sewing, that is your meditation? Where are you rushing off to? You've already gone wrong. Craving is already flooding your head. You've got no idea what's happening." This was a shaft of life to me. I'd been sure that I was making merit. I thought that merely doing the job was good enough. I'd get it done quickly and go on to something else. But Lumpu pointed out my mistake. "What's the hurry?" And this is another small thing. Suan Glue is I think it's a place that Ajahn Sumedho actually went to. And this is something that then came up. This is again Ajahn Jayasaro writing. Auspicious dreams at Suan Glue. The biography of Lumpo, written in the late 60s, although an important source for the present chapter of this book, consists of little more than a number of short anecdotes woven together in a traditional style. There are large and frustrating gaps in the story. In 1981, as Lumpur's health started to rapidly decline, two of his senior Western disciples decided to interview their teacher and garner what more information about his early life with a view to writing a new biography. This was after I had arrived in Thailand, and was when Ajahn Kawesiko and Ajahn Titignano were spending time, more and more time, with Ajahn Chah. They set off with a new tape recorder and many blank tapes, and with great anticipation returned a few days later glum with disappointment. Apart from two stories of Lumpur Cha's prodigious appetite for Chinese noodles as a young monk, Lumpur was almost completely uncooperative. The only interesting answer he gave, if a rather puzzling one, was a response to queries about the most important event of those early years. Lumpur cited three auspicious dreams he'd had, which were as follows. One night he dreamt that somebody offered him an egg, which he tossed onto the ground. The shell broke and two chicks ran out, and he caught those chicks, one in each hand, where they immediately changed into small, delightful boys, just learning to walk. A voice announced that the one on his left hand was called Boon Tong, and the one on the right, Boon Tum. After a while, Boon Tong caught dysentery and died, nestled in his hand. The voice said, "Boon Tong is dead, and now only Boon Tum remains." Then Lumpur awoke, and the question arose in his mind as to the significance of the dream, and the answer appeared in response. It's merely natural phenomena. And at that, his doubts disappeared. The next night, he dreamt that he was pregnant. His belly was swollen, and it was difficult for him to move around. And yet, at the same time, he still felt that he was a bhikkhu. Just before he was going to give birth, he was invited to take his meal at a thatched hut in the middle of a field bounded by a stream. There were already three monks upstairs, and they'd started their meal. Lumpur was close to his time, and so the lay people invited him to eat down below by himself. As the monks above him ate, Lumpur gave birth to a radiantly smiling boy with soft hair on the back of his hands and the soles of his feet. Lumpur's stomach had shrunk. He felt that if he had really given birth and checked to see if there was any blood or fluid to be cleaned up, but it was dry, and he was reminded of the birth of Prince Siddhartha. The lay people started to discuss what would be the best thing for a monk who had just given birth to eat, and they decided on three fried fish, doctor fish. Lumpur felt exhausted, and he didn't want to eat anything, but he forced himself to eat so that the donors could make merit. Before starting his meal, he gave the child to the lay woman to hold, and on finishing it, they gave it back. As he received it, the child fell from his hands, and he woke up. Again, when the doubt arose in his mind as to what the dream meant, simply by reminding himself that it was a natural phenomena and nothing more, his mind was put to rest. The next night, Lumpur dreamt once more. This time he had, together with a novice, received an invitation to take his meal in a mountain top. The path twisted around the mountain in like the whirls on a snail. It was a full moon, and the mountain was very high, its peak cool and verdant. An exquisite piece of cloth had been made into a sunbreak for them, and they sat down in its shade. After some time, they were invited into a cave in the mountainside. Lumpur's mother, Mae Pim, and his aunt, Mi, and a large number of lay people were waiting with offerings of food. Mae Pim had bought a watermelon and other fruits. Mae Mi had bought grilled chicken and duck. Lumpur joked with his aunt that if this was the sort of food she was fond of, she should move into a town, and she smiled broadly. After the meal, Lumpur gave a Dharma talk, and then he woke up. The meaning of this of the dreams remain unclear. The meaning of the dreams remain unclear. Perhaps in the first one, Boon Tong, which is gold merit, represents worldly wealth, and Boon Tum, Dharma merit, but also the word for orphan, spiritual wealth. The second and third dreams are even more obscure. The fact that Lumpur Cha never thought it necessary to explain them is, of course, an important consideration. And if anyone had ever suggested interpretations to him, and only a Western disciple would have been so forward, his most likely response would have been to laugh and tell them not to think so much. And yet, one can't help wondering, if the symbolism was irrelevant, why did he consider these dreams so important? We shall never know. Yes, we shall never know. As I mentioned this morning at Wat Pop Pong over this time, it's a bit like a Dharma rock festival. You have, as I say, thousands of people, 500,000 people coming through the monastery. There are 200 branch monasteries of Wat Pop Pong, at least. And they set up stalls to provide food and drink. And the villagers come, and there's food and drink. It's not a time when there's rain. I suppose Wat Pop Pong is maybe a couple of 100 acres. Maybe not quite as much, maybe only about 150 acres. And it has two sections. The older section is where it has a wall around it, and that was the wall that Lumpur Samedo helped build at one point. And that's the older part where the bigger trees are. And then in the early 80s, maybe a bit before, late 70s, early 80s, some more little bits of land were purchased, which were at the time paddy fields. And since then, the trees have grown up. And that now has a wall around it as well. And that outer area is where the Chedi is, the stupa is. It's where the Kuti was that Lumpur stayed in for the last years of his life. It's where there's an outside sala. And at the front, where there's also a little museum with bits and pieces in it, and the area around is the area of the stalls, where the stalls are set up. The Wat Nanachat, the International Forest Monastery, they usually undertake to provide all the drinks. I think that's what they usually do. And one year, Abayagiri, the monastery in America, at the leading of the abbot of that monastery, Ajahn Pasano, the disciples of Abayagiri arranged to go and cook and provide food for people in at Wat Pop Pong. And they cooked sort of a sort of batter with sugar. I can't remember what it's called, something quite traditional American, deep-fried batter with sugar, sort of strings of it. I went down a storm with with the guys and the villagers, and they were just so surprised to see Westerners just cooking up at an outside store. And through the night of, which probably, you know, ended whenever it was this morning, different people would have given talks all through the night. And the way that they do it is that I think they probably still do it this way. They have sort of half hour or three quarter hour slots, and they try to make up a program of monks that will give the talks at these times. And the way that the talks go is that you come, you listen to a talk. If you feel you want to get up in the middle of the talk, you walk out. If you want to come back later, you come back later. You don't feel that you have to stay till the end of the talk. Walk in and out. And what used to happen in the very old days was they'd always put, because the talks would go through till dawn, and there'd always be a few monks that would be quite capable of talking through till dawn whenever they started. If they started at midnight, they'd talk for 6 hours. So they'd put one of those monks on towards the end and just leave them going through, because they talk through till dawn, and then at dawn, the monks get dressed and then they go on arms round through the villages. But I'm not planning to talk through till dawn. This is probably enough, and wish you very well. But that's a little bit about Lumpur. Of course, it's just a taste, and the best way, obviously, to honor your teachers, the best way to honor the Lord Buddha is to practice and follow the suggestions, Patipati Puja. And the best way to say thank you to your teachers is to practice well, practice consistently. The best way to say thank you to that teacher that lives with you 24 hours a day, all the time, that which is always teaching you. The best way to cultivate that gratification is to keep a sense of practice and awareness of that. Stay with that which is not bound by time.
Through the supreme power of all these, May darkness and delusion be dispelled.
Blessed ones, disciples,
who have practiced well.